Listen to more news from WBEZ anytime on the WBEZ app. Start each day informed. Tap and listen live or on demand. Available on iOS and Android.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset's weekly news recap. To break down those stories and much more, we checked in with Brandis Friedman, anchor of WTTW's Chicago Tonight and host of Chicago Tonight Black Voices, Chicago Tribune political writer Dan Petrella, and Chicago Sun-Times reporter Mary Norkel. We've had some out-of-town visitors making national headlines this week, so Dan began by telling us about the Texas Democrats who've been making Illinois their summer home.
Yes, there are a few dozen state lawmakers from the Texas House Democrats who have fled the state of Texas to try to stop the Republican-controlled legislature there from redrawing congressional district boundaries ahead of next year's midterm elections at the behest of President Donald Trump, who's trying to get Texas to find five more Republican seats so that his party potentially doesn't lose control of the U.S. House of Representatives in the election next year. And it sort of set off this whole, as we heard at the top, bidding war is the right term for it, but sort of a cold war over who's going to redraw lines in which states controlled by which party. And the folks here from Texas have gotten the backing of Governor Pritzker and other Democrats here who are saying that this sort of very rare mid-decade redistricting that Texas is looking at doing is just, you know, brazen politics trying to I don't know. Well, people probably have used the phrase steal an election. I don't know if that's quite a fair characterization, but definitely a if not unprecedented move, a rare one, and one that is quite unusual.
Yeah, so much so that we have Texas politicians urging the FBI to round them up, and we're now hearing that the FBI has agreed. Can they do that?
Probably not. No, there's no federal
law involved here. Like, is there jurisdiction in Illinois?
What has happened is the Republican House Speaker in Texas has issued a civil warrant, which Governor Pritzker and others have said hold no weight here in Illinois. It would be quite unusual for federal law enforcement to get involved. There's a lot of politics at play here. John Cornyn, the senator from U.S. senator from Texas, who made that request to the FBI, is in a tough primary battle against Ken Paxton, who's the Republican Attorney General in Texas. So there's some politics going on there as well. Paxton. I believe earlier this morning or maybe late yesterday, filed a request here in a state court in Illinois out in Quincy to ask for assistance bringing these folks back to Texas. But we'll have to see how that all plays out.
So, Mary, a bomb threat was made Wednesday. This was at a West Suburban St. Charles hotel where the Texas legislators were staying. What are the details that we have?
Yes, so we don't have a lot of details, but what we do know is around 7:15 Wednesday morning, police, St. Charles Police and Kane County Sheriff's Office were called in to investigate reports of a bomb threat. Mm-hmm. 400 people about were evacuated, including some of those Texas Democrats that are at the center of this whole thing. And there was a thorough search that was conducted. Nothing credible was found. Mm. And everyone returned back to the hotel. But a press event was canceled. Pritzker and some other Democrats here in Illinois came out with statements denouncing the threats and, you know, wanting to keep everyone safe. Yeah. So,
and we don't know who is behind this at all?
We don't know. Nope, we don't know. And I don't know that we will, but we'll see how things progress. It's definitely still developing.
Reconfiguring congressional maps, that's nothing new, Brandis. So is this, though, a bit more brazen than we've seen before?
I think some folks would say it is more brazen. Like
Dan used a similar word.
Right. Well, a lot of folks this week have said, you know, of course, like all the states are guilty of gerrymandering, right? I think J.B. Pritzker's defense has been, yeah, but we do it like right after the census comes out. And, you know, we leave it as it is until the time comes. Mm-hmm. You know, and he also ran saying that he would not sign a map that was gerrymandered. And then he did it. And so, you know, obviously it set off this sort of, you know, war, California saying that they're considering it as well. And now, J.B. Pritzker saying it's, you know, it's on the table. We had, House Minority Leader Tony McCombie on our show earlier this week as well. And, you know, she raised that point, and also that the state should be doing fair maps, right? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, a lot of folks have said that, right? That lawmakers should not be drawing the maps themselves and choosing who, you know, getting like, to choose who votes for them.
How is that ever going to be fair?
Them. And how is that fair, right? So, that's where we are.
Yeah, you interviewed Illinois' Senator, U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. This was last night, I believe, correct, right? What were his thoughts on this redistricting drama?
Yeah, so what he said was he does not think it's going to get to the point, you know, that slippery slope where Texas does it and then California does it. So then maybe Indiana does it, now Illinois responds. He doesn't think it's going to get to that point. I'm not quite sure what he's basing that on, if he thinks that Texas is going to fail mm-hmm. and the Democrats will be successful. I don't know. But he does say that he thinks that if we do go to fair maps, it should be a nationwide thing, that all states should do it, not just a few states here and there, because yeah. then that obviously leaves other states with the advantage to make themselves the color they want to be.
Mm-hmm. What are legislators saying, Dan, about when they might head back to Texas?
Their plan is to...
When are they leaving?
Their plan is to wait out the current special session that Governor Greg Abbott has called in Texas, which I believe runs through the 19th. You know, we've seen efforts like this from lawmakers previously in Texas and in other states where there's some issue coming for a vote that they don't have the numbers to win or to block. So their way of doing it is fleeing to other more friendly places. You know, Wisconsin, maybe over a decade ago, had this issue when there's some labor stuff going on. And what usually happens in these situations is they end up giving up and going back home and end up losing the battle. This seems to be perhaps a little better funded than some of those previous efforts. So one of the things to really watch here is whether they can actually, you know, wait it out and run out the clock on this special session. Although I did see this morning that Abbott said he would continue calling special sessions until the maps pass. So this doesn't seem like it's an issue that's going to go away anytime soon.
So sticking with this redistricting showdown, because there's more to give here. It could move to Indiana next. Here's why we think this, because Vice President J.D. Vance paid a visit to the governor of Indiana. What do we know about that meeting, Dan?
Yes, Vice President Vance was there yesterday. Governor Braun in Indiana said that they listened to what he had to say. There was no indication whether they are going to attempt to redistrict in Indiana. One of the targets, if they do, is Representative Frank Mervan, who represents sort of the northwest Indiana area that borders Illinois, one of only, I believe, a couple Democrats in Indiana's delegation. So he would potentially be a target, or his district would be targeted if they do try to redraw the lines. But, you know, it's a numbers game here when the margin that the Republicans have to control the House is so narrow, and they've already gerrymandered so many of these states,
right?
You know, as close to, you know, total dominance as they can. So it's going to be interesting to see where and how they try to squeeze out a couple more seats here and there so that they can potentially maintain that majority.
Yeah, for sure. And just piggybacking off some comments Brandis made a moment ago here, Mary, we got governors in California and New York talking about countering with a Democratic redistricting effort. So you think this could be the start of just a nationwide fight over congressional maps?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. As Brandis and Dan have both said, it's tough to say exactly where this is going to go from here, and if it will almost end up being like a game of chicken, like who's going to back down first.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, we could see Illinois get involved if Pritzker kind of stays on this path that he's on of leaving the door open for mm-hmm. redistricting like that. I think the thought and the attitude that some Democrats and Republicans probably have toward this is, well, okay, if they're going to do it, we're going to do it too. And, you know, it could get ugly. It could lead to, you know, a domino effect mm-hmm. of redistricting around the country, but we'll see if it ends up.
We think Republicans are maybe worried about next year's congressional midterm election.
That seems to be the case.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, how confusing might this be to the voter if that were to happen, right?
Yes.
Like, because you remember when redistricting happened a few years ago, of course, right after the census, seats started to change. And, you know, as reporters, we all kind of pay attention to this stuff. And I'm like, wait, so whose district is what now? And
right.
This moved where?
I do remember that.
Especially when you consider how gerrymandered some districts are. I mean, for voters, what if you study on the wrong race and then you show up at the polls and you're like, oh, darn, I don't know who to vote for now.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you bring up Pritzker. I want to play this here because while all this has been going on, he's been making the rounds, of course, in national media. He's paid a visit to The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. This is him, though, on NPR responding to questions about some of Illinois' oddly configured congressional districts.
These same Republicans who are complaining about the way maps are drawn in Democratic states, they're the ones drawing maps in their states that are quite unfair. It isn't the case, though, let's be clear, that just because you have more of one party than another in a state, that that's an unfair map. And in Illinois, Republicans have every opportunity to run for and win office. They don't win here because their ideas are bad. And by the way, they're about to lose elections in 2026. Because of the big, ugly bill, because of the policies of Donald Trump, and they're trying to change the game. Indeed, they're trying to cheat midstream.
Wow. Tell us how you really feel, Governor. Fighting words, right, Mary?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think just to follow up on what Brandis said before, I think this is so confusing to the average person. And I think it's also much more in the public eye than it maybe has been in the past. And, you know, I can see a situation where somebody sees, you know, snippets of headlines saying, oh, Texas Democrats are here. Oh my gosh, there's a bomb threat. Now California's involved, and it is all getting very much in the political weeds.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's our job, is to make sure people understand that. But I think the point here is to just make sure that people are understanding that this isn't just, you know, some behind the scenes inside baseball. It really would be something that would affect a voter.
Good point.
Right. Yeah, it would absolutely impact, you know, who's representing them in Congress. You know, the other thing is, to the governor's point about, you know, Republicans not getting elected here because of their ideas. We brought this up last night, and I saw Fox pointed this out by comparing the representation in Massachusetts to the representation in Texas. And if you look at Illinois, our representatives, three of whom are Republican, that makes them 18% of the Illinois congressional delegation. Listen to me reading numbers like I can do math.
Okay, stats.
Compared to 44%, I think, of voters in Illinois who voted for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently that's one Republican whose ideas voters like, because they are electing, those 44%, they voted for Trump, even though all of our what are those votes that you get? Electoral college votes. Went to Kamala Harris during the election. But I mean, there are some Republicans in Illinois who might vote differently. So
yeah.
I'm not sure his argument holds up.
And Dan, you kind of nodded when I mentioned Pritzker making the national rounds here. What do you think all of this does for the speculation about Governor Pritzker and his national political interests?
Yes, it definitely only adds more fuel to the fire. It is interesting.
Like, are you running for president, sir, or not?
He's got to run for a third term as governor first. That one comes first, which he's already said he is. But, you know, I think it's interesting, too, because it does kind of put one of his larger political flip-flops front and center on this whole idea that we were talking about gerrymandering. Because, as Brandon said earlier, he campaigned originally in 2018 saying that he would not sign a gerrymandered map. And then without really any explanation or defense, went ahead and did it when his party in control in Springfield drew maps that were gerrymandered. I mean, the Princeton gerrymandering project has given the maps an F. I think any fair person who looks at them can look and see that they were drawn in a way to elect Democrats in certain places and to minimize the representation of Republicans. Now, that's not to say that the same hasn't happened in Republican-controlled states. That's absolutely true. But yes, he definitely is milking this opportunity to put himself out there, not just in front of folks here in Illinois, but all across the country. Like you said, the NPR interview, his appearance on Colbert, and something he's been doing a lot of this year since Trump came back into office.
Well, you know, most Illinois Democrats have been showing support for the Texas legislators, but Mayor Johnson also expressed some frustrations. Let's listen.
As much as I appreciate Illinois helping out people from Texas, the South Side and the West Side could use that same level of energy.
So is Mayor Johnson growing increasingly frustrated, Brandis, with what he sees as a lack of support coming from Springfield?
Feels like we've been here before with the governor and his frustration with Springfield, with other people who came from Texas previously, who were bused here by the governor at the time, the migrant crisis that we had a couple of years ago. And so, yes, because he, along with some of his friends at the CTU, of course, and some, but not all of his friends at CPS, have also been, you know, crying that they need more money from the state. And actually, very recently, the state realized, oh, we do owe CPS a few $100 million more, which helped to, I think, put a slight dent in that deficit that CPS has. So, yeah, perhaps he is going more growing frustrated. However, I don't really know what his solution is going to be. Springfield has given no indication that they are going to give any more money than what's already agreed.
Maybe he needs to visit yet again.
Law or whatever. Maybe he should go on down there. Like, if there's a special session that gets called in
again.
The veto session in the fall, then I think so. But I'm not really sure what his answer would be.
FaceTime never does wrong.
He can text the governor. Right? I don't know how often they talk. We don't see them together very often anymore unless it's, you know, something cute.
So the last of four convicted ComEd co-conspirators was sentenced to a year in prison. What exactly was Jay Doherty convicted of, Dan?
So Jay Doherty was sort of the middleman in this scheme that ComEd had cooked up to bribe Mike Madigan by giving really no-work jobs to some of his associates, a couple former ward workers, and a couple former aldermen who were ostensibly supposed to be doing lobbying consulting work for the utility, but really were being paid to do not much of anything at all. So part of how they did this is they parked these folks as subcontractors at Jay Doherty's lobbying firm, and they got money through ComEd, and they didn't really have to do anything to earn that money. So, the judge who sentenced him to a year sort of described him as the proverbial cash in the envelope in this situation. It was a little more sophisticated than that, but really when it comes down to it, that's sort of, how the whole situation worked out. And he, was a ComEd lobbyist himself and was really prominent in the city for his role as the president of the City Club of Chicago, which is a forum for movers and shakers in the political and business world in Chicago to get together and journalists like us to sit in the back of the room and while they hear speeches from politicians and policymakers and things like that. And, he in the sentencing process admitted to kind of shifting from this sort of soft influence sort of idea to, letting being the big guy on campus, I think was his phrase that he used in his statement in court, and sort of told the judge that he felt like he had gone astray and not lived up to his values. But this sort of closes the book on this chapter of this corruption investigation that's been going on for 6 years. Well, there's the whole idea that these convictions will get appealed, and so we'll see what happens down the road. There's been some weakening of the federal bribery statutes that were used in some of these cases, with a Supreme Court decision stemming from a case over in Indiana. So this, it may be is a to be continued.
Yes. I don't know that it closes the book just yet. I feel like we're going to be talking about this in the weeks to come.
It ends the chapter.
It ends the chapter for sure. What else should we know, though, about Jay Doherty? Because he's held some prominent positions.
Yeah. The City Club of Chicago is really, the big thing where he was known and he worked for ComEd. He was also involved a lot of philanthropy with the Misericordia Foundation and the Special Olympics. A real sort of connector in the political world. And I think the image that will always stick with me from the trial of him is this video that was secretly recorded by a former ComEd vice president, Fidel Marquez, who was cooperating with federal investigators. They were sitting at a restaurant in Saputo, it's called Saputo's in Springfield, which is popular among the political and media folks in Springfield during session. Been there many late nights myself. But Jay Doherty was talking about the $4,000 a month these Madigan associates were being paid through his firm. And there's this grainy hidden camera video of him holding up four fingers that I think will always stick in my mind as I think about this case.
All right, Brandis, let's turn to state politics. Governor Pritzker signed a law expanding pension benefits for police and firefighters. So exactly how does this change their pension benefits?
Okay, so it is supposed to boost retirement benefits. My colleague Heather Sharone is the real expert on this, obviously, but for some Chicago police officers and firefighters. However, I think there is some concern that, the city is already facing this financial deficit this year, supposed to worsen next year, and there is fear that this is going to make it worse.
Yeah.
But the governor signed it, and apparently Mayor Johnson did not ask him to veto it. But again, this is one of those instances where the mayor was like, yeah, we need more help from the state. In whatever form that might look like. This is after S&P has already downgraded the city's.
Yeah, they're sounding the alarm. Because they're saying this bill adds, $11 billion to Chicago's pension debt. So
yes. Mm-hmm. So But I mean, allegedly, it is obviously supposed to improve the benefits for those first responders. But the concern is how they're going to pay for it.
Let's turn to another budgetary topic, Mary. Cook County is investing $2 million. This is to help women coming to Illinois seeking abortions. Tell us more.
Yes. So built within the Cook County budget was an amendment to invest $2 million in something related to reproductive rights. And it ended up being a $2 million grant given to the Chicago Abortion Fund, which has seen, you know, just massive increases in demand since the 2022 Dobbs decision, which essentially struck down Roe v. Wade, stripped away reproductive rights, turned it back to the states. Illinois, and specifically the Chicago area, is kind of an island within the Midwest. You know, we see so many people seeking abortions traveling here. There was a report, I think it was last year, that essentially concluded that of all people seeking abortions out of state, one in four of them will come to Illinois. So it's the demand is huge, and that $2 million is meant to not only go toward medical services, but also wraparound services. So things like childcare, transportation, food costs for people, to essentially just lower that burden of getting here and getting the abortion that they're looking for. Obviously, we can't talk about this without mentioning that not everyone's on board with it. Mm-hmm. You know, the abortion debate has heated up, you know, not only leading up to the Dobbs decision, but also since.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's going to be battling out in the courts, in the legislature, in the streets, you know, for the foreseeable future. So, you know, Cook County, Board President Tony Preckwinkle and other commissioners really took a hard stance to say, you know, Illinois will be a haven for people looking for abortions.
This is the side we're on, and
absolutely.
We're sticking to it.
Yeah, and, you know, you look around the country at other states and other counties, and that is not the case. So we'll see how it shakes out from there. But, you know, it's definitely going to change some things with this extra funding.
Yeah, Illinois has definitely made itself the state to watch.
Yes.
Right, across the country.
Absolutely.
All right. So despite a backlog of immigration cases, we're seeing immigration judges being fired. This is happening at an alarming rate since Donald Trump became president in January. Now, Senator Dick Durbin spoke out about it as well this week. Here he is.
These cases are in our system, subject to our due process requirements. And it appears to me that if you're dismissing the immigration judge, you're bailing on a due process requirement. That's a serious mistake.
That's a serious mistake, he says, Brandis. Why are these judges being terminated?
Nobody knows.
Yeah, because they're saying I didn't even get notice.
Yeah,
right?
The judges themselves are saying that the notice they got, it comes at, like, you know, some strange times, right? Like one, I think our friends at ABC7 were reporting that one judge received it while she was on the bench in the middle of a docket.
Jeez.
One of the ones who appeared with Senator Durbin earlier this week said that she received, I think, an email or some sort of notification while she was, you know, on vacation with her family. And so all of them are saying they haven't really gotten any reasoning. That same judge expressed that, you know, since Donald Trump came into office, I think they're down by about 100 judges on that particular, you know, those particular immigration courts.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are being fired and some are just quitting, right? Because I think they kind of see what's going on.
See the writing on the wall.
Yeah, so we're not quite sure just yet about, like, what the reasoning is. Of course, a lot of folks, immigrant rights advocates, are of course saying that it is all political. I think Senator Durbin is saying something to that effect as well.
The Trump administration is saying, oh, we're clearing the backlog.
Honestly, I'm not sure what the Trump administration is saying, other than, you know what, other than I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, all of us are like, I don't know.
He's been on this mission to deport undocumented or, you know, people here without legal status from the country as quickly as possible. So that's their idea of clearing the backlog.
Well, yeah. So that's their idea of clearing the backlog, right? But if you get rid of judges, then you're clearly not so concerned about using these judges to adjudicate the cases of people, of the immigrants who you believe to be here illegally.
Shrug. In a lot of cases. I mean, that's what's happening here is there's no trial.
As we've seen, many of them have been rounded up and sent to Alligator Alcatraz or CCOT or other places.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Another group lost jobs this week, Mary.
Yes.
Chicago Public School janitors.
Yes. So Chicago Public Schools announced this week it would essentially do away with private contracts with custodial companies. Around 1,200, a little more than 1,200 workers were laid off, with a plan to rehire 750 under the as actual district employees. So if you do the math there, it'll be around 500 fewer jobs. And, you know, that has set off a slew of concerns for schools advocates, worried about, you know, just the quality of their schools, the cleanliness of their schools, safety. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, the other side of it is CPS is facing this massive budget hole that, you know, there are so many questions around how they're going to fix it. So there's a lot at play here. Again, we'll see how it shakes out, but around 750 of those custodians will be hired back is the plan.
Right, and doing the math that you pointed out there, I mean, 500 fewer janitors. I'm just thinking of the last time I visited my kids' school. Brandis, I'm looking at you. I know you're a parent too. Like, it was.
I don't know how they keep those schools clean as it is anywhere.
So I'm thinking if you have fewer, you know, if you're cutting the custodian
staff.
Well,
and it's not like the district has that many fewer schools. And there's a whole other conversation that folks can have about that, right? And while enrollment has been going down, I mean, you still have this, like, something close to the schools and the number of students that you had at the end of the last school year. So even though 700 and something are going to be rehired, to lose 500 and something, that is significant.
No, it's no small number.
That's no small number at all. And children, they're messy, right? Like, the schools are going to get dirty.
I don't want my kids working in a dirty school.
I remember when they started the Aramark contract, not to date myself, and at the time, there were lots of complaints about Aramark, and that contract, it's been over for a little bit. But even then, I remember schools, there were lots of complaints about the cleanliness of their schools and teachers saying that they were having to go into their own pockets to buy supplies.
Right.
This time, the district says that they're going to implement some technology that's going to, I don't think this is cleaning technology. I think it's technology that lets you know, when something's been cleaned. And I guess that technology will also let you know when something hasn't been cleaned. Because I'm imagining that's what's going to happen when you cut this many custodians.
Well, and another important point here is we're not that far off of a pandemic when cleanliness was, you know, top of mind.
Absolutely.
And, you know, there's kids get sick all the time. It really is a
we're so hyper aware now, right?
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. And one thing I also just want to mention is the figure they're hoping to save here is around $40 million of more than $500 million. Dollar deficit in their budget. So we'll see if it's worth it. I mean, there are definitely questions surrounding that.
I will be watching my next
I'm sure you will. Your next visit to your daughter's school.
And I'm sure most parents will. That's because there has been complaints about the cleanliness of these schools for years now.
I'll be in the office like with my, you know, my, what's that, that cloth?
Your white glove.
Yeah, my white glove, just checking the dust on the counters.
And a black light.
Yes, exactly. Now, the same week that CPS announced those layoffs, it also revealed that it would expand investment. Now, this is in what's called sustainable community schools. What are those, Mary?
Yes. So the sustainable community schools model is essentially designed to create more of a community hub out of a school to provide resources not only to the student academically, but, you know, provide after school programs, family support, adult learning programs, things like that, that, you know, just kind of support the student as a whole person is kind of the goal there.
And where are these going to be located?
Mostly on the south and west sides.
Okay.
There are going to be 16 more of them, bringing the total to 36. So they almost doubled their amount with this announcement this week. And, you know, the million-dollar question here is how much will it cost? And again, with this budget deficit that we've been discussing, we'll see, again, if it's worth this investment.
Yeah.
It is. They do receive extra funding for these programs, and we weren't able to get a solid dollar amount of how much they're going to cost.
How much? Is the extra funding covering the whole thing? Because, again, Brandis, they're facing a $500 million budget deficit. So I don't know if they can afford this.
I don't know if they can afford it either. And I guess I'm guessing, right? I don't know because I have not looked at the budget, which has to be approved by the end of August. And I think they're actually going to start school for the first time in I don't know when without a budget being approved. So, you know, so set that aside. But the other thing is, is this already written into whatever budget proposal they're going to approve later on? Because this is also part of the CTU contract. This was negotiated several years ago that CTU and a bunch of advocates who support CTU were calling for this kind of support and this kind of wraparound. I think our friends at Chalk Butte have been reporting, though, or part of their coverage this week included the fact that some of the performance at these schools, it's only marginally different from non-sustainable community schools. Yes, in some of the same communities as far as achievement for those students.
Yeah, and that is something that I think the supporters of this would push back on a little bit. And, you know, the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. You know, the CTU and Mayor Brandon Johnson are both huge proponents of this. And, you know, they definitely kind of target the academic performance and improvements in mental health and things like that. And that is also, both of those things can be difficult to quantify. So it's hard to tell how effective they are. But I think, you know, in the face of such an extreme budget deficit, it's going to be difficult to prove to people that it was worth the investment.
Pivoting here, because we got news this week that Republican Congressman Darren LaHood will seek re-election for Illinois' 16th district. What are the political implications here?
Yes, and not to take us back to the topic of gerrymandering, but just for a little bit, his is a very interesting district, a great example, stretching from the Wisconsin border to south of Peoria. And sort of snaking around more Democratic-friendly areas.
Hold on, let me Google that map real quick.
In Rockford and the Quad Cities to, anyway.
Oh, yeah, this is that strangely shaped one that Colbert pointed out, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. So LaHood is, I believe, in his sixth term in the U.S. House. He was a former Illinois state senator, the son of a former Republican congressman from Peoria, Ray LaHood, who was transportation secretary in the Obama administration. One of the better known names in the Illinois Republican Party right now, somebody who is seen as a potential candidate for governor or the United States Senate, instead choosing to stay in a seat that was drawn safely for him. And it just, I think, speaks to the current state of the GOP here in Illinois, where, you know, it's very hard for them to find prominent candidates who are going to challenge folks like Governor Pritzker and Secretary of State Alexei Gignoulias and compete against whoever comes out on top in the primary for Dick Durbin's soon-to-be-open Senate
seat.
So it'll be interesting to see both
parties. Staying out of those crowded races.
Yes. And it really is a logical decision, I think, for him. It's a race he can likely easily win as opposed to taking a leap at an office that he might have a tougher time. It's been very hard for Republicans to win statewide in Illinois.
Safe. So top Trump administration officials, they're saying an Indiana detention center could actually become the next alligator Alcatraz. Dan, what is this about?
Yes. So part of the issue here is that Illinois has a state law that doesn't allow correctional facilities in the state to contract with ICE for immigrant detention. So,
But Indiana doesn't.
Yes, but Indiana does not have a similar law. So when they round up folks here in the Chicago area and elsewhere in Illinois, they need somewhere to house them. And so this would be 1,200 empty beds at a correctional facility sort of in north central Indiana, north of Indianapolis, sort of near Kokomo, if anybody knows where that is. And it's unclear exactly who is footing the bill or how much this is possibly going to cost taxpayers in Indiana, whether the federal government's going to be picking up the full tab. There's already been complaints that, these beds were empty because of understaffing at correctional facilities in Indiana. So there's some concern there. But it's the second time in recent weeks where the federal government has looked for more detention capacity in Indiana. There was a military facility there that earlier had been announced as another immigrant detention facility. So it's really ramping up the ability for the federal government to detain folks potentially, who are arrested or taken into custody here in Chicago.
Yeah, U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem was at one of their field offices. She was in West Suburban Lombard this morning, highlighting arrests of immigrants that she called the, quote, worst of the worst. She took some jabs at Illinois' political leaders, too.
These individuals would still be out on our streets today committing crimes and attacking people and harming them and hurting our children if Governor Pritzker and Mayor Johnson had their way.
And anyone can chime in here, but do you think Secretary Noem is here today because of what we were talking about earlier, Pritzker's efforts and all of his comments this week?
I would think that that's not entirely unrelated. This is actually her second visit to Illinois this year for one of these sort of news conferences. The other one, she really sort of stepped on a rake, so to speak, because she did it in the name of a Springfield woman who was killed, but it actually turned out that she was a progressive activist who was very much opposed to a lot of the policies of the Trump administration. And so it didn't turn out particularly well for her, the Trump administration, that time around. So haven't seen her full comments from today, but, you know, I don't think any there are sometimes coincidences in politics, but sometimes not. So
sometimes there are not. It's like he came out swinging. I got to come out swinging, too. In the opposite direction, you published a story today, Mary. This was about how White House actions are impacting our LGBTQ plus community.
Yes, so this is related mostly to healthcare and the LGBTQ plus community, and essentially the Trump administration, since he took office for the second time, has, you know, attacked healthcare, rolled back LGBTQ plus. Mm-hmm. Regulations and rights, and, you know, that's been something that activists have been sounding the alarm about for, you know, months and years. And so that part is nothing surprising, but what is, you know, maybe not surprising, but new is cuts to a program that was really meant to research a HIV vaccine. Mm-hmm. And so what we did was spoke with the founders of Chicago's first AIDS unit at Illinois Masonic in Lakeview.
Oh, they're here locally. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yes. And the unit is no longer functioning anymore because of, you know, the improvements made in AIDS research and activism and, you know, mitigating HIV effects. But, you know, the nerves that are coming from these founders and doctors and nurses and former patients and family of people that died on the unit is that if these cuts are made and they get more extreme from here, then we'll be going backwards, not only in LGBTQ plus rights, but also in access to healthcare. Yeah. For something that was so stigmatized for so long. So I'd encourage everybody to take a look at that story, suntimes.com, yeah, and learn more, because there's a lot there that I didn't know.
Mm-hmm. And Chicago also lost a longtime LGBTQ advocate this week, Brandis. What can you tell us about Lori Cannon?
Yeah, Lori Cannon, it looks like a battle with pancreatic cancer, which, as we all know, it's one of the scarier cancers. She was 74 years old, and she's known for her advocacy work over the years, working with ACT UP Chicago, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, and especially with the in-home meal delivery program that she started, you know, like back in the 80s and 90s when gay men were dying and no one was listening. You know, she started... you know, she was one of the first to start showing that humanity,
yeah,
right? And
mm-hmm.
and we're not going to forget about you. And, you know, the first thing that she says, that you hear her say in the firsthand series that WTTW did back in 2020, she was one of our profiles for that. She says, you know, these young men, their mothers just never could deal with their gay, you know, they just couldn't accept their gay son who also had HIV or had AIDS. And I am here for them in their dying moments.
Wow.
To, you know, to, mm-hmm. you know, to honor them in their lives. And so I mean, I also encourage folks to visit wttw.com/firsthand and find that segment on her, because it really it really gives you a sense
in-home
of who she
in-home meal delivery
is.
Program.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And she still runs, what is it, Grocery Land? Or not still runs, but she's still like the organization.
She's very involved. Yeah, I actually, mm-hmm. for that story on Unit 371, spoke with Cannon about a month ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, right before her death, and she was still very, very involved.
How did she seem to you?
You know, she was starting to have some concerns, but, I think she was a little bit in denial, perhaps, that, you know, this was going to be severe. So, you know, it's really a tough loss for the community. You know, people really looked at her as family. And I think, you know, just in speaking with her and in talking to others about her and her role in the community, it's clear that she made AIDS activism her entire life. She was, you know, on the unit holding hands with patients as they're going through their worst days. And also after AIDS was not so much of a, you know, immediate issue for so many people, she still was running Grocery Land. She still was making sure that people living with HIV or living with AIDS were supported by their community.
Not forgotten. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, rest in peace, Ms. Cannon.
May she.
We've got an update on a story that we covered last week on the recap. Weiss Memorial Hospital in Uptown on the north side has closed its emergency room. So a posted sign notified patients of the closure this morning. The federal government says Weiss has been in and out of compliance with safety standards for months, and it's cutting Medicare and Medicaid payments to the hospital starting tomorrow. So we're going to keep following that story as it develops. Pivoting to you, Dan, because dozens of communities in the Midwest and West, including seven in Illinois, they found out yesterday their newspaper is going to be closing. News Media Corporation, which is just west of DeKalb in the town of Rochelle, it prided itself on being, you know, sort of the voice of small town America. So what happened?
Yeah, I think this is really a reflection of the state of the media industry writ large, and the newspaper industry specifically, right now. These small town papers especially are really struggling.
We're hearing too many of these stories lately.
And, it's a detrimental thing to these communities because oftentimes this is the only source of local information. I'll mention it's also coming at a time where some of these same areas might be losing public media stations as a result of decisions coming in, coming from Washington.
So these towns are essentially news deserts now?
Yeah. I mean, by and large, you know, some of them are kind of near like Rockford or DeKalb or the Quad Cities or things like that. So they might get some coverage occasionally from the larger newspapers nearby, but those staffs are also much, much smaller than they used to be and not covering as much as they used to. So they attempted to find buyers for some of these properties and were unable to. So are sort of discontinuing as a going concern, as the phrase goes. But it's really concerning. You know, it leaves people in these communities to rely on Facebook or other social media.
Nothing to get their telling news. Them what's going on in their community.
Right. And I was just going to say, a lot of what we see on TikTok or on Twitter or wherever else you go to find your news is not really specific to your local community.
Right.
Or if it is, it's not always
and
reliable.
It's possible it hasn't been verified, fact-checked. These people, you know,
could be
perhaps
anything.
Aren't doing it as their you know, job with as much rigor as a journalist would do.
Exactly. Let's turn to something different, Brandis. A Lutheran pastor from Chicago, he's been elected the church's first black presiding bishop. What should we know about Yehiel Curry?
This is kind of a cool story, and props to my assignment manager, Ava Martin, for catching this one for us. So the evangelical, and I was told it's evangelical, which is different from evangelical, the evangelical Lutheran Church in America, they've elected their first black presiding bishop, Yehiel Curry, who, you know, he's from, you know, south side of Chicago, and he has been the leader at the Metropolitan Chicago Synod for a while, several years. And so he has been elected. I think it's kind of a similar process to the one that elects the Pope, but I think it's much more out in the open. And he knew that his name was, you know, sort of in the running. He recognizes that he is, you know, the first black leader of a very predominantly white denomination. It's like 95% white, 1% black, 1% Hispanic nationwide. But he focuses on, you know, the work and the mission. He seems very humble and appreciative of the fact that, you know, that he's been seen by, you know, his fellow parishioners and, you know, fellow Lutherans who saw him fit to take on the role. He started off as a Catholic, and somewhere along the way he found he was invited to a church or an event where the mission, it was called Simba, and I forget what it was, but it, you know, supports black youth. And I think he appreciated that. It is work that, you know, that he's still passionate about and still does. So
awesome. Well, congratulations.
Congratulations to him. Good luck.
Here's another first, Mary. Lots of people are enjoying the Chicago River. You know, lovely, lovely place to take a stroll. You know, maybe have a glass of wine while you're watching the boats go by. But apparently people now want to go swim in it.
Yes, they do.
And they can finally they do this. This is after a long time coming.
Yes, it's been a long time coming. So there is a group called A Long Swim that is hosting the inaugural sanctioned swim in the Chicago River that's meant to benefit ALS research, but also, you know, kind of mark the progress in cleaning up the river that, you know, so many groups have been supporting for years now. So that'll take place in September. And, you know, it's obviously meant for, you know, very seasoned swimmers and people that, you know,
so I can't
handle
go.
Their open water.
I can't go. That rules me out.
You can try.
That rules me out.
Swimmers.
I can swim, but like not swim.
And is this where you want to do that?
Exactly.
If you're not an experienced swimmer.
However, if you are interested, you have until Monday to sign up. I'm looking at you all.
It's a short timeline. I'm busy this weekend. I can't sign up yet. I've got a lot to do.
You don't have time to sign up.
I don't have time to sign up.
And it's really going to happen this time? Because there was talk about this, what, a year or two ago?
It was supposed to happen last September.
Yeah. Yes, it was. So there was some drama with the city. You know, they were denying permits. They were denying the permits, and the swim ended up taking place in Lake Michigan, which it took the novelty out of it for some of the swimmers. So maybe they'll be back this year, but yes, it has been approved by the city, and you know, unless there is another snag, which is always possible, it'll take place September 21st.
First open water swim in almost a century. Wow.
Again.
98 years.
98 years. All right, we'll move the conversation now to the western suburbs to congratulate the Clarendon Hills Little League team. They're headed to the Little League World Series in Williamsport, Pennsylvania next week, and we will be cheering them on. Our thanks, because that is the end of the weekly news recap, to Dan Petrella of the Chicago Tribune, WTTW's Brandis Friedman, and Mary Norkel of the Chicago Sun-Times. Thank you all so much. Have a great weekend. Swim in the river. Why don't you?
Why don't you?
No, thank you. Call me. Tell me how it went.
Thanks for having me here on Reset.
Thank you.
This episode of the Reset podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman, edited by Dan Tucker, and mixed by Sienna Greaves. To catch more conversations like this, consider subscribing so you never miss an episode. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Have a great weekend, and we'll meet again soon.